All right, so check it out. You know how we talk about all the weird stuff they sneak into our food, our air, or even our clothes? Yeah, it turns out most shirts are basically made of plastic. You're sweating in chemicals, man. That's why I switched to Hypernatural. It's wild. They make their fabric from jade stone and crab shells. Yeah, you heard me right. Jade and crab shells. The jade keeps you naturally cool, like literally drops your skin temp down a few degrees. And the crab shell fibers, they fight odor and help your skin stay fresh all day long. So you can wear it longer, wash it less, and not smell like a dirty old gym towel. They use a fancy cotton, mother-of-pearl buttons, and zero junk. No polyester, no chemical dyes, and none of that synthetic garbage. It's clean, it's sustainable, and honestly, it's just cool gear. You can wear it anywhere, the gym, the range, whatever, and it looks legit. Go to hypernatural.com and use my code ZEROSIGNAL at checkout, and you'll get yourself 20% off. And get yourself the cleanest, most comfortable shirt you've ever worn. That's Hypernatural, nature engineered for comfort.
You're tuned into Zero Signal, a show about what they won't say and what you're probably already thinking. No fluff, no filters, no bullshit. Let's crack it open.
At this time, I'm going to ask you to fasten your seatbelt.
Tonight, we're going to talk about a king who barely gets a line in the Bible, and a tower people have been arguing about for 3,000 years. Nimrod, the Tower of Babel, big names, bigger questions.
Yeah, tiny resume, mighty hunter before the Lord, then the epic backstory explosion, empires, idolatry, a furnace, and the first conspiracy board meeting. Benedon, who tells us?
Yeah, man, we'll unpack scripture, the rabbinic frameworks, the archaeologists who point to ziggurats, and the internet detectives who swear Nimrod started the Illuminati. Spoiler, the Bible is a bit short on some of these details.
The Illuminati, which, you know, makes the extra so interesting. Midrash turns a two-line genealogy into high drama, a rebel king, a city that tries to reach heaven, and a god who hits the reset button on human speech. It's a warning about pride and power and what happens when people try to make a name for themselves.
Yeah, man. Imagine the plain of ancient Mesopotamia, mud brick and the smell of baked clay. People chanting in one language, hauling bricks up tall step towers meant to touch the sky. It's a literal engineering project. A symbolic warning, a political critique, or a gateway to heaven?
And a lot of people ask, where does Nimrod fit in? Biblical geography puts his kingdom in Shinar, right in the Babel neighborhood. Later writers made him the architect, the tyrant, the inventor of idolatry, and sometimes the foil to Abraham. It's like the origin story for don't trust centralized power.
Yeah, and we'll look at all those versions. We'll check out some of the text, and we'll ask some good modern questions. Which parts are ancient Ptolemaic, and which parts echo real Mesopotamian architecture like Edmonenki, and how did a footnote become a symbol for an empire in rebellion?
Plus, bonus round, why does Nimrod keep turning up in conspiracy lore? From Victorian Pulmic to late night forums, he's been recast as everything from proto-mason to occult kingpin. We'll separate the entertaining stories from the credible claims.
Yeah, so tonight, primary texts and tall tales, clay bricks and power plays, myth making and modern myth hunting. If you like history with a side of mystery, you're in the right place. So we're going to talk a little bit about Nimrod's genealogy. So, fun fact, he is the great-grandson of Noah. His grandfather was Ham, and his father was Cush. So, this places Nimrod post-flood. He is from the Hamite branch through Cush, later associated with kingdoms in the south and east. You're looking at Africa, Arabia, and Mesopotamia, depending on interpretations. So, to look at a quick biblical description of Nimrod, he was the first mighty one on earth after the flood. He was known as a mighty hunter before the Lord, and he is largely considered the founder of the first cities and kingdoms. Looking at some of the Hebrew words assigned to him, so the word Gibor in Hebrew translates to mighty one, and the meaning of that is warrior, champion, hero, strongman, and powerful ruler. But there's also another interesting kind of caveat to that, is that the word Giborim, which is plural, is associated with giants, and we can delve into that a little bit deeper into the episode. Because there's some debate whether or not he was, in fact, a giant that could have come from his mother's genetic line, which I shy away from. But there's some interesting conspiracies where he may have transformed into a giant later in his role.
It's interesting. The stories always come back to these giants, these fallen angels that procreated with women on Earth and really established themselves. When we look at Nimrod from a Christian lens, it really starts in Genesis 10, sometimes called the Table of Nations. Out of that geology, a name really stands up, and that's Nimrod. Scripture calls him a mighty hunter before the Lord and credits him with the first centers of a real empire, Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. Then the text says, from the land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Calah, and Rezin. In other words, Nimrod is not a campfire legend. He's the kind of leader who blends wilderness into city grids, who organizes labor, who sets stones and laws, and sends tax collectors into motion. Christians through the centuries have noticed the ambiguity of baked really into those lines. Mighty hunter before the Lord can simply mean the Lord's sight, a man of renown. Some rabbis and church fathers, though, hear a grimmer nuance. Before, as in the face of, or in defiance of, a hunter of men, a consolidator who uses unity for control. The text doesn't gossip. It just gives you his portfolio and lets Babel supply the morale. That's pretty wise. Scripture often introduces power without varnish, and then it shows what it does when tested by God's purpose. Here's why Nimrod matters for us here today. He's the archetype of the audacious founder. He gathers his people. He standardizes tools. He points at the horizon and says, there. Charisma plus coordination equals skyline. And that combination can bless or break communities, really depending upon the aim. Dominion was found in Genesis 1, calling to a steward of creation, can easily slide into domination. Nimrod's story invites us to ask sharper questions about every modern builder, the CEO, the mayor, the platform architect, the influencer, who can rally millions. What are they hunting? Who do their cities serve? And do their plans align with God's design to fill the earth with life, or to really compress it into one tower, one brand, and one name?
Yeah, it's also interesting to see characters throughout other cultures who have a story that's very similar to Nimrod. You mentioned the city of Uruk, and that is associated with Gilgamesh. So historians kind of date this writing right around the time that they associated the writing of Nimrod. So it's roughly 2700 to 2500 BC. Gilgamesh is a semi-mythic king. I think many of our listeners have heard of Epic of Gilgamesh. I think it's the oldest known written myth out there. So to frame it a bit, so Gilgamesh is also labeled as a legendary hunter and warrior. He had superhuman strength. He was a city builder. And according to them, he was two-thirds divine, one-third human. So again, you look at maybe a parallel, maybe a hint to this mighty man, possibly a giant. And he was the king of Uruk, which is one of Nimrod's named cities. And he had similar accomplishments. He built massive fortified walls. He was a central figure in the oldest epic ever recorded. And he's a monster slayer. He apparently slayed Humbaba. He travels the world seeking immortality. And we'll get into some of the other stories about how Nimrod may have died, may not have died. There's that one floating out there. It's interesting. We'll touch on that a bit. And the city of Uruk had colossal ziggurats. And ziggurats are step pyramids. They're not your typical pyramids that you may see in Egypt and maybe some other places. But like in South America, they had the step pyramids as well. And they had these temple complexes dedicated to the little G gods, Anu and Inanna. So that's interesting. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, he's searching for immortality and he dies a hero, but he ultimately accepts his human limitation and passes on. There's also a story of Sargon the Great. Sounds like a character from the Lord of the Rings, but he is the king of the city of Akkad. And again, this story is placed between 2300 BC, give or take. And it's, according to scholars, it's a fully historical narrative. So he was the first empire builder in human history. He rose from humble origins. And I would think back in that time, if we're looking at post-flood world with just a handful of people getting off the ark, I bet you could argue that the first few generations, everybody's coming from humble origins. And he is credited for unifying countless nations under one language administration. He mirrors the first mighty king archetype. And again, Gilgamesh, he founded the Akkadian Empire. He conquered from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean Sea. He created the world's first standing army, and he standardized imperial rule. And again, he promoted temple and ziggurat construction across his empire. And in their story, he eventually dies of natural causes as well, and his empire ultimately fractures after him.
What's interesting is after Genesis. Nimrod becomes something of a legend. Later in Jewish and Christian writings really flesh him out as the symbol of empire. The man who took human unity and kind of turned it into that dominion. Some traditions describe him as the first world ruler, a tyrant who weaponized unity to consolidate power and lead rebellion against God. Others cast him as a brilliant civilizer, bringing cities, laws, and organizations to chaos. The Bible doesn't give us much biographical detail, but these stories all kind of pivot around the same question. What happens when leadership forgets lordship? In Jewish Midrash and later Christian commentary, Nimrod is often linked with Babel, the one rallying the people with the promise of strength and permanence. Lest we be scattered is a famous saying. Some traditions even put him in direct opposition to Abraham, representing two worldviews, the kingdom of man and the kingdom of God. Whether or not those connections are literal, I do think they carry spiritual weight. To me, it's fascinating that Nimrod's name, once associated with might and success, later became a synonym for folly. The linguistics twist feels like poetry and justice, human greatness that ends with irony. For us, Nimrod becomes like that mirror. When we admire a builder or a leader, what exactly are we admiring? Vision and courage are good gifts, right? But detached from humility, they kind of drift into idolatry. So when you see a headline about a billionaire promising to change the world or a government aiming to build back better, I think we remember Nimrod. Ambition itself isn't evil, but in scripture, ambition without surrender becomes rebellion dressed up as progress. That first empire was built on that trade-offs where we've been rebuilding ever since.
Yeah, you brought up the Hebrew Midrash, and there's an interesting story from the book of Jasher. In the Hebrew recounting of these tales, Esau, his story is intimately woven with Nimrod. If you look at it from the biblical point of view, the book of Jasher is apocryphal or extra-canonical. In the Bible, there's really no correlation between Esau and Nimrod. Nimrod, he's mentioned very few times in the Bible. Most people who read the Bible know the story of Esau. Esau was the firstborn. Interesting kind of visual here. When Esau was born, he was born fully haired and slightly red. So he was, can you imagine having a baby that comes out and it's red and hairy? Must have been quite the...
It sounds like a Scottish person from like the medieval times.
Right.
With the big axes.
As the story goes, Esau's out in the field, he comes back and he trades his birthright for a bowl of soup. And there's some people out there that have some interesting theories and stories, and a lot of them relate back to the Midrash. So according to the book of Jasher, after the death of Abraham, Esau frequently hunts in the fields, and he also was known as a great and mighty hunter. So he shared the same title with Nimrod, and you can draw the conclusion they're probably rivals. They probably know about each other. And Nimrod grows jealous of Esau and ends up watching him closely. And on a particular day, both are out hunting in the wilderness. Nimrod separated from his main group and walks with two of his men, and Esau hides and waits. So he ambushes them, he draws his sword and beheads Nimrod in a sneak attack. He ends up fighting and killing his two guards as they cry out for help. So that's how the Hebrews, according to the Midrash, how Nimrod is killed. And so as Nimrod's mighty warriors hear these other guys crying out for help, they rush toward the scene and Esau flees. He escapes with Nimrod's valuable garments, and these are special clothes bequeathed by Nimrod's father, Cush, which, okay, so now we're floating all around biblical history here. According to Jewish Hebrew Midrash, when this is going to get really deep, so just bear with me here. And again, some of this is, I don't want to call it extra theological. It's not in the Bible, but there is some kind of foreshadowing. You can see it in between the line. We've all heard of the Joseph and his Technicolor Dreamcoat, right? So the legend or the Midrash states that when the serpent, aka Satan, Lucifer, tempted Eve, and when they sinned, like their eyes were open and they were ashamed of their nakedness. According to the Midrash, Satan was wearing a garment that was given by God, and as one of the punishments, God took this garment from Satan, gave it to Adam, and this garment was passed down the line all the way down to Joseph, and that was the garment that Joseph was given to by his father, and his brothers got jealous because he was able to prophesy and talk to the animals, and pretty crazy story. The conclusion here is that when Esau killed Nimrod, he took this garment from him. So after this fight, obviously he was exhausted, he was probably beat the heck and back, and he runs home to his brother Jacob, declaring he's about to die, and he sells his birthright for a bowl of lentil soup. So I assume at this point, he's just desperate, he's probably beaten up, he probably thinks he's about to die from his injuries, or it's just a matter of time until these guards find him, and he's quoted as saying to his brother, what good is a birthright if I'm dead? I can't even inherit it. So at the age of, according to the Hebrews, Nimrod was 215 years old when he died, and this kind of led to the fragmentation of the kingdom, which which kind of goes back to some of these other stories we hear about from other cultures.
Do you know, upon his death at the age of 215, when he was decapitated by Esau, do you know if this was pre or post the fall of Babel?
So that's unknown. So as we branch off later into the episode, at one point in time in my life, I thought God destroyed the Tower of Babel. But if you read the scripture, he just confuses the languages so people stop building it. There's certain stories suggesting that the tower was supposed to be like 5,300 feet in the air. And I don't think they got near that height. As we look through the archaeological record, the ziggurats during King Nebuchadnezzar's the second time that were 91 meters tall. So you're looking at 200 plus or minus feet. So some of the assumption is that he just built on top of the ruins of the Tower of Babel. Other than him being a credit with commissioning the temple build, it's unknown if he died before the confusion of the languages or after. But gotcha. Like I said, in other tales, he dies of old age.
Gotcha. Yeah, since we talked a little bit about Babel, and it's one of the most famous stories in early Christian literature. So maybe we'll touch on it for a little bit for our audience that perhaps don't follow the Christian faith or don't have a deep understanding of it. But Nimrod's map of cities points to one plane, one people, and one project. Now, the whole earth had one language and the same words at that time. They settle in Shinar and say, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." That's ancient text speak. Uniform units, fired hard, sealed with butanum, perfect for going vertical. Then comes the mission statement. "Let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its tops in the heaven, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth." I think we pause there. Nothing in that line says we want to worship. The verbs are urban, technological, and repetitious. City, tower, name, control. And the last clause, "lest we be scattered," rings against God's earlier blessing and command to be fruitful and fill the earth. In other words, the fear of scattering is a fear of mission. Rather than trusting God with dispersion as blessing, they pick consolidation as an insurance plan. It's a unity as an idol. Then the holy irony, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower. The tallest things human could dream still requires God to stoop. And what God says is pretty striking. "This is only the beginning. Nothing they propose to do will now be impossible for them." Now, let's not panic about human skill. It's a diagnosis about the human heart. Power plus one language equals limitless capacity to go towards the wrong at scale. So God does two merciful things, really surgical things. He confuses their speech and he scatters them. Judgment, yes, but also protection. The break against totalizing projects becomes the gift of many tongues and of many places. I think two quick notes of imagination, held humbly, not as like replacements for revelation. First, the text material details line up with what we know of Mesopotamia building, brick factories, butanum mortar, stage towers we call ziggurats. That doesn't prove every contour of our picture, but it helps listeners visualize the world the Bible is speaking about. Second, we have Babel's. Making a name is the thread that runs through the whole Bible. God later says to Abram, "I will make your name great, but as a promise received, not a monument achieved." Babel grabs. Abram, trust. One hoards unity. The other receives blessings to be a blessing. And I think for Christians, there's a grace-filled bookend in Babel. In Acts 2 at Pentecost, the Spirit doesn't erase languages. He lets everyone hear the mighty works of God in their own tongue. To me, this is not a return to one language. It's a unity through diversity, a foretaste of the redeemed humanity gathered from every tribe and language around the throne, which means that the scatter of Genesis 11 is not the end of the story. It's a guardrail that keeps us from worshiping our other towers while God writes really a better ending to our story. One city, the New Jerusalem, not built behind bricks, but given by his mercy.
So you mentioned the Bible verse where God says nothing will be impossible for them. I've thought about that for a long time. What do you think he's saying, or what do you think he's suggesting? Because I go back and forth on that, because God can just, he can do whatever he wants to do. Not 1,000 years before, like, he just wiped out the world in the flood. So when he says that, he's not saying that out of fear of man, of usurping God. What do you think he is suggesting with that statement? I'll give you my point of views, or what I couple of things of what I think, but what do you make of that?
It's a good question. I think first, God acknowledges his creation. He created us to be architects here in this world, to act like him, to create and to achieve things. But he also has a guided purpose and mission for us to create a unique and diverse world of many skin colors, of many races and ethnicities. And he doesn't want us to be siloed into one place. He wants us to spread out and become many within that. I think it's just a kind of an acknowledgement that man is capable of, when I say man here, man and female, is capable of many things because God created us to be very powerful, to have dominion over this world. But should our creation lead afoul to God's design, then I think we're in trouble, man. And that's when God steps in and says, you know what? You guys aren't going to speak the same tongue. I analyze that more from a modern perspective than probably people did back in the day. What's ironic, right? We're talking about the Tower of Babel. And when you look at, you know, what some people say, actually how tall it was. When I used to dream about the Tower of Babel, and you think it would be like reaching the space and the heavens and all that. And many people say it was only about 25 stories tall. Like it was tall, but it wasn't like crazy tall in modern comparison. Now you look at all the things that we have today, artificial intelligence, the internet, many of these things are reuniting our language because it can translate in real time. And it makes me think like maybe he was trying to stop that from happening back then. Perhaps he was referencing that from back then. Because look how much evil has come by uniting our tongues. A lot of evil stuff, false tongues, lying, prostitution, pornography, any kind of the crazy stuff that you could think of today is done online and done on the dark web. All this evil is coming about. So I wonder if it was a future acknowledgement of what would happen as you march more towards Revelations instead of Genesis, of destruction of the world for a second time. So perhaps he was trying to eliminate that, tying the whole world narrative that we have together today.
Yeah, I'm on the same page with you. I think when he says there's nothing would be impossible for them, he's not saying that out of fear of somehow us getting into heaven and taking it over. I think he's referencing, I think you have to look at it, you know, post-flood and then end of days. I'm sorry, pre-flood and end of days. So pre-flood, I am convinced that everyone spoke the same language. And I think you can make the inference here that after everyone got off the ark and started to procreate again, everyone spoke the same dialect. Why else would he have to confuse the languages if they didn't? So I think what he was doing was he was watching and knowing that if he didn't confuse the languages, then you're going to go back under into that immediate one world government. You have Nimrod here trying to create an empire. He's a mighty hunter and a mighty man, and he's doing it out of pure physical prowessness. I think God's thinking, like, this can't happen yet. I don't want this to happen yet. And if I allow it, then we're just going to go right back into what existed before. One world government, one language. So by confusing the languages, it made people kind of branch off into Africa, Asia, Europe. And it's interesting how each part of the world has its own ethnicity. You have like black people in Africa, you have Asian people out in Asia, you have the whites in Europe, and then you have the Native Americans out in North America and South America. And it's interesting, it seems like they broke off, and then through natural selection and the climates that they lived in, they expressed certain genes and certain pigmentations. But I agree with you. I think it was to keep this whole one world type government and one person from oppressing everyone. And by splitting us up, he allowed culture and diversity to thrive.
And we saw later in the Bible, after Babel, we saw Sodom and Gomorrah. And this was another large and mighty cities that existed that God eventually destroyed. And the reason why he destroyed it was because so many people were together and they were doing some really evil, bad stuff within that city. And it was detestable to God. So it seems like when we start getting a lot of collective of people together that speak the same language, they start serving different masters versus serving God. And that seems to always build up problems. Like God's, if you continue down this pathway where you're surrounded by all these evil works and all these evil deeds, you're going to run right into the grave and then eventually make your way into hell. We see it, the kind of story repeating and the warning coming along as well.
Yeah, it's also interesting that the Hebrew Midrash, one of his reasons for building the Tower of Babel was to, quote unquote, make a name and to avoid the scattering. So after everyone got off the flood and they started repopulating, God said, go out and settle, like get away from each other and make your own cultures. And it almost seemed like Nimrod wanted everyone to stick around to avoid that kind of separation. And it's also interesting because according to certain rabbis, the stories, and these stories are all over the place, it's just not in Hebrew or Middle Eastern culture, but even the Irish have them, and to a certain extent extent Asians and even all the way out here in the Americas. But there's suggestions that giants or Nephilim descendants helped make these ziggurats or the pyramids by moving the bricks that were made. And in Haldane, so it's ultimately what happens is the construction of Babel just completely stops. And then nobody can talk to each other. So nobody can get together and make sense of what to do anymore. Like the leadership structure is just destroyed because of the lack of communication. And it's also, I heard this other guy, I don't know, a couple years ago, I wish I remembered his name. I don't believe it, but he suggests that pre-Babel, everybody could communicate telepathically. I don't believe that per se. And he suggests when God confused the languages, he took that ability to communicate telepathically and people were forced to branch off and create their own languages in order to survive and communicate and work together.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've heard that before. I don't know that there's much evidence to say that was true, but it is interesting. I think when you look at the local Mesopotamian worldview, a ziggurat wasn't an act of rebellion. It was like an act of order. They called these towers stairways for the gods. This literal bridge between heaven and earth. The city of Babylon, like others in the area, the Ur and Uruk, were mapped around the ideal, a sacred center where the divine could come down and bless the land. Ritual processions wound through the streets towards the base of these towers, and priests ascended ramps carrying offerings, believing they were keeping the world alive. Aligned with heaven. At the summit sat a small temple. It was elevated and very quiet, meant not for crowds, but really for the presence, a symbolic dwelling place of a god. To Mesopotamian eyes, this was harmony and hubris. They weren't storming heaven in their theology. They were creating cosmic order through architecture. Now, that's what makes the biblical critique so profound. The same structure that one culture saw as aligning earth with heaven, scripture portrays as mankind's attempt to take heaven by strategy rather than by grace. And the tower becomes a monument, not to worship, but to control. In other words, same building, different theology. As Christians, we can see God's wisdom in that contrast. It's a reminder of the heart motive matters more than the blueprint. And then I think in human unity can really glorify God or glorify yourself. And that tension, that pull between coordination and control, between reverence and self-praise, it shows up in every modern project, from mega cities to mega servers. I don't think that question has changed. Are we building a bridge for God's glory or a platform for our own name? And that's what I really see with Nimrod's story. From obviously, I study a lot from the Christian biblical lens, but it seems like Nimrod was out to make a name for himself and not to make a name for God. And usually when you do that, you're led afoul.
Yeah, I want to kind of circle back to this Gilgamesh and Nimrod parallel. And we touched on the confrontation between Esau and Nimrod, but the Epic of Gilgamesh has something very similar. So obviously the hero in that epic is Gilgamesh, but he also has an ally, a friend named Enkidu, and they team up with each other. Enkidu is described as all things, a hairy, nature-attuned figure who's very reminiscent of Esau's hairy description in Genesis. And they set out to slay Humbaba. Humbaba is a giant guardian of the cedar forest appointed by the gods. And again, it's an ambush that happens in the remote wilderness. They end up beheading this Humbaba, and the subsequent divine consequence is Enkidu's death. So this is a direct mirroring of Esau's hidden attack on Nimrod during a hunt, leading to Esau getting exhausted and giving up his birthright. So both stories involve challenging a powerful type being and acquiring a symbol of power. So in the story of Gilgamesh, it's cedar treasure versus Adam's garments. So that's interesting that two close cultures share a similar story. It's interesting because it would make sense for one side to say, my guy won, and the other side to say, the other guy died. That's, what do they say? The victors write history. In this Epic of Gilgamesh, they claim Enkidu dies and not Nimrod. There's also the story of Hercules and the Nemean lion. So Hercules, divine hero and skilled hunter, slays the invincible lion in an ambush and then skins it to wear its hide as invincible armor. So this kind of parallels Esau's theft of Nimrod's valuable garments that grant dominion over animals and has strength. So Hercules' labors are imposed by the king of the time. I'm not even going to try to say his name because it's Greek and I didn't practice it before I started this podcast. Here again, we have a tyrannical ruler that he has an indirect rivalry with. It's echoing Nimrod as this despotic slain king killed by a rival hunter. These are all interesting. There's also Set and Osiris in Egyptian mythology. So we're going to just talk about the parallel elements here and the key differences. So Set, he's a chaotic desert god associated with hunting and red hair, similar to Esau. And he murders his brother Osiris. And Osiris is the fertile king and ruler akin to Nimrod's empire building. He does this out of jealousy in wilderness setting. And so he disassembles him and scatters his parts, not unlike being beheaded. There's also other Jewish midrashes that suggest that Esau cut Nimrod into 12 pieces and spread him around. Once Set kills Osiris, he temporarily gains power, but is ultimately defeated by Horus, Osiris' son. Again, this is rivalry over kingship or street cred, and the inheritances parallels Esau slaying a Nimrod with motifs of ambush and a transfer of divine authority. This is all interesting that you see this, again, this underlying thread weaving all these things together.
Yeah, to go back a little bit, you talked a little bit about it, about Gilgamesh and Nimrod. I think one of the more intriguing theories floating around that I saw in the alternative history forums and prophecy blogs is the claim that Nimrod and Gilgamesh were actually the same man. The reasoning goes something like this. Nimrod's cities include Erech, that's the Hebrew form of Uruk, the great Sumerian city-state. Meanwhile, the Epic of Gilgamesh hails its hero as the mighty king of Uruk, two-thirds divine and one-third man. Both figures are described as legendary builders, hunters, and rulers who pushed human limits and really challenged heaven itself. Early Assyrianologists working in the 1800s before the cuneiform was fully understood noticed this similarity. When George Smith and others first translated the tablets of the Epic Gilgamesh, they misread one title as Izdubar, and for a while speculated that this could be the biblical form of Nimrod. It was an understandable leap. Both names were wrapped in mystery, both towered over early Mesopotamian lore, and both embodied the restless human kind of drive for glory. Modern scholarship, though, tells a bit of a different story. Excavations and linguistic studies summarized in resources like the Maiden Project show that Gilgamesh is a composite mythic hero stitched together from memories of several Sumerian kings who ruled around 2700 BC. There, he is part legend, part morality, representing humanity's struggle with morality and these divine limits. Nimrod, on the other hand, stands in scripture as a real post-flood figure, presented within Israel's genealogies and moral history. His life isn't a myth, it's a message. And I think that overlap between them is something about identity. It's about the archetype. Every culture remembers a mighty builder who tried to rise above the gods, and every culture tells how that story ends. And that's where the parallel becomes spiritually powerful. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, the hero searches for immortality, and then he fails. He learns that no wall, no city, no achievement can make him live forever. And in Genesis 11, Nimrod's tower stands as humanity's collective attempt to achieve the same thing, to make the name that cannot die. Both stories pulse with the same heartbeat, the human hunger for eternal meeting without kind of this eternal grace. But scripture ultimately completes the story, the myths only begin. Where Gilgamesh fails and Nimrod falls, Christ succeeds. He offers that immortality they sought, not by climbing a tower to heaven, but by bringing heaven down to us. The tower's builder story ends in confusion, and the redeemer's story ends in resurrection. And I think that's the final contrast about these two characters, is where both of these mighty men, perhaps they existed in different forms, failed, Christ succeeded, and he brought heaven on earth to us because he lives within us, and we embody him if we are sanctified and saved. But I thought it was interesting that some people thought, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, that these two people could perhaps be the same man.
Yeah, let's kind of revisit some of the multicultural renditions of Nimrod's death. So Islam has one as well. The story is Nimrod, again, a tyrannical king who claimed divinity and persecuted Abraham. I'll touch on that story here after I run through this. But Nimrod defies God by building a tower to reach heaven and even shooting arrows at the sky. And in response, in Islamic tradition, Allah sends a swarm of mosquitoes, or particularly a single mosquito, to enter Nimrod's nostril and burrow into his brain. And it torments him for a year, some say 40, some say 400, driving him mad. And it gets so bad to the point he begs for death, and he strikes his own head with a hammer and ultimately perishes from, I guess, the hammer strike. So again, multiple renditions of Nimrod, Gilgamesh, what have you, Sargon. And it ranges from being beheaded to having a mosquito burrow into your brain to hitting yourself with a hammer to old age. So you have all these stories, and I wonder how many of them could be Nimrod and how many of them could be, say, his sons that maybe took control, or some sort of extended family member that maybe was over a certain city, and they're all being conflated to Nimrod. I don't think they all can be Nimrod. I lean toward the Hebrew Midrash version, though we will get into something when we start touching on the conspiracy side. There is a, you ever hear of Gilgamesh's resurrection chamber?
God, I don't even want to know.
Yeah, we'll save it for the end of the episode when we get to the conspiracy part. But yeah, I personally lean toward the Hebrew Midrash, where, again, it's not in the canonical Bible, but there is apocryphal pseudepigrapha that were books that were written sometime before Christ. Another interesting rabbinical text, and from the Babylonian Talmud, is one of the most famous Midrashim, often called Abraham in the Idol Shop, depicts young Abraham challenging his father's idolatry. So Terah owns a shop selling statues of Ur of the Chaldeans. So he's left in charge. Abraham smashes all but the largest idol with an axe, then places the axe in the remaining idol's hand. When Terah returns and questions him, Abraham claims that the idols fall over an offering, exposing their lifelessness. Furious, Terah brings Abraham before Nimrod for judgment. Abraham debates the king. He rejects the worship of the sun, moon, and idols in favor of the one true creator God. This kind of illustrates Abraham's early iconoclasm and logical rejection of polytheism, and showing how he discovers God through reason and observation through the world. Building upon the idol smashing incident, Nimrod, who claims again to be divine himself, condemns Abraham to death in a massive fiery furnace. Where else we heard this? We heard this in Babylon. And it's like history's repeating itself here. And this furnace is located in Ur on the Valley of Dura. So Abraham's brother Haran is also implicated. And in some version, Haran wavers from his faith and is consumed by the flames when he jumps in after seeing Abraham unharmed. But anyway, either way, God intervenes. Nimrod puts Abraham into this furnace, and when Abraham steps in, it turns into a blooming garden and sending angels to fan him. So this allows for him to emerge unscathed after days of being in this blaze, and this miracle kind of converts onlookers and humiliates Nimrod, who briefly acknowledges God, the one true God. But again, like Pharaoh, he relapses. So another story of faith triumph over persecution. And we've seen this story of Daniel in Daniel 3, where the three prophets are sent into the bull's belly furnace and they don't burn.
Yeah, that's a good one. What I think is always interesting, right? Some people are going to say, I don't care what you're saying, Jay. You're just a crazy Christian and I don't believe any of that mumbo jumbo. But I think what's really spectacular is the story of Babel doesn't only live in text. It lives in artifacts that have traveled the world for the past two centuries. Since the 1800s, explorers and archaeologists have been digging through the plains of Mesopotamia, pulling up tablets, seals, and inscribed bricks from ancient Babylon. These objects were scattered far and wide, some in museums, other in private collections, and a few even in the black market trade. What I saw was, in recent years, this has really come full circle. Thousands of stolen or looted pieces, tablets, scrolls, and monumental fragments have been returned to Iraq, including the famous Gilgamesh Dream Tablet, which once sat in a private collection in the U.S. before being returned. Publications like the State Magazine have really covered these returns, which shine a light on the ongoing struggle over provenance and the paper trail of where artifacts come from and who rightfully owns them. There's something really poetic about the world's records of human pride and power being shuffled back to the rightful home, and history kind of gets scattered and gathered. These recovered tablets aren't just museum pieces. They're confessions carved in clay, reminders that empires rise and fall, but truth ultimately endures. And for us, that's more than archaeology. It's a quiet affirmation that God still knows where every fragment lies. So I just find it interesting. There's a lot of archaeological digs, and I want to get into a couple of the stories of people that tried to rebuild the tower itself, but I find it fascinating. So if you're a naysayer and you don't believe in Christianity, that's okay. There's still evidence that it existed.
Yeah, so there's a interesting fellow by the name of Dr. Judd Burton. So just a little bit of a backstory as to his profession. He's a historian, anthropologist, archaeologist, and the director of the Institute of Biblical Anthropology. So he's presented several alternative theories on the Tower of Babel in various podcasts and in his recent book. So he challenges the traditional placement of the Tower of Babel being in Lower Mesopotamia, which is modern day Iraq, and associated with Babylon. Instead, he thinks it's in the heart of Turkey, specifically tying it to the ancient archaeological site of Göbekli Tepe. So this proposal draws on biblical, apocryphal, and archaeological interpretations, framing Göbekli Tepe not as just the world's oldest known temple complex, but also a post-flood hub for like spiritual rebellion, ancestor deification, and possible influence from the Watchers, which are the fallen angels from Enoch. Burton suggests that the biblical land of Shinar in Genesis 11 refers to part of modern Turkey. So he suggests that this aligns with post-flood migration patterns from Mount Ararat, also in Turkey, which makes sense if you think about it. If the Ark did land on the top of Mount Ararat, you would think that civilization would have branched out from Turkey and not from Babylonia or Iraq, though they obviously made it there. So he sees Göbekli Tepe dated to around 9600 BC, shortly after the end of the last ice age, and he thinks this fits the timeline for early post-flood human activity, predating known Mesopotamian ziggurats by a couple thousand years. So he also draws the connections with the Watchers from apocryphal texts like the Book of Enoch. Burton suggests Göbekli Tepe was influenced by the Watchers, who taught forbidden knowledge to humanity. He links this to Nimrod as the mighty hunter and Babel's builder. So he portrays the site as a center for occult practices aimed at defying God, similar to the tower's goal of reaching the heavens. So the site's burial, intentionally filled in around 8000 BC, could symbolize divine intervention akin to the confusion of languages. It's also interesting to note that in the Midrashes, they say, I think, I could be wrong, I'm going off my memory, a third of the tower was destroyed by fire, a third was left above ground, and I can't remember what happened to the other third, but this would line up with this Midrash a bit. He suggests that rather than a mere communal site for worship or a hunting shrine, Burton interprets the site as a place for deifying the ancestors and to achieve immortality. The iconic kind of T-shaped pillars are seen as representations of deified figures like Adam, linked to the bull god Anu, and Eve, tied to the fertility goddess. Animal carvings such as foxes and boars symbolize cosmic regeneration and resurrection rituals, reflecting humanity's attempt to regenerate the dead gods and to transcend mortality, paralleling Babel's theme of unified ambition against the divine order.
That's a wild one.
Yeah, so archaeologically, the site has massive stone circle, terrazzo types floors, and has the use of early concrete, which are like essentially synthetic bricks. And it matches Genesis 11:3's description of baked bricks and bitumen. So its age and complexity suggests advanced organization by hunter-gatherers, possibly inspired by supernatural knowledge. We go back to this influence of fallen angels and forbidden knowledge.
What I think is interesting is people continue to seek it out. Before Christ, and then even more towards modern times. Even Alexander the Great, at the height of his empire, he really couldn't resist the allure of Babylon's tower. He arrived there in 331 BC. Ancient sources say he was struck by the ruin of the great ziggurat, its steps crumbled, its shrine long abandoned. And in true Alexander fashion, he ordered the whole thing demolished and rebuilt on a grander scale. Workers were set to clear the site of bricks by brick for reconstruction, but then Alexander fell ill and died before the project could actually begin. The dream of re-raising that tower died with him at that time. But if we fast forward a little bit, in the 1980s and 1990s, Iraq's ruler, Saddam Hussein, launched one of the most controversial heritage programs of the modern Middle East, the reconstruction of ancient Babylon. What began as an archaeological restoration really turned into a political performance, a modern empire builder attempting to graft his image onto the legacy of the world's first. Saddam poured millions of dollars into rebuilding the ancient city walls, parts of Ishtar Gate, and even a palace overlooking the ruins, in a deliberate echo of Nebuchadnezzar II. he ordered new bricks to be stamped with his own name, each reading, "In the era of the victorious Saddam Hussein, the President of the Republic, may God preserve him, the great city of Babylon was rebuilt." That symbolism wasn't subtle. He cast himself as the new King of Kings, heir to Nebuchadnezzar's throne, and reviver of the cradle of civilization. Archaeologists who later studied that site described the work as half restoration and half propaganda. The reconstruction blurred the line between conservation and invention, often layering fresh concrete and mortar brick directly over these fragile ancient foundations. Some ancient walls were rebuilt several feet higher than their original height, and Saddam's modern palace, nicknamed Saddam Hill, was placed directly atop archaeological remains. To professionals, this was vandalism dressed up as patriotism. To Saddam, it was legacy building, a way to inscribe his reign into the same timeline as the Babylon's former glories. And yet, I think the irony runs deep. While scholars call his methods problematic, the project also rekindled global attention on Babylon. After decades of neglect, tourists, journalists, and documentary crews, they returned, and Babylon was back in the headlines. And for many Iraqis, it became a source of cultural pride. However, politicized. The city that symbolized human arrogance in scripture became, for a time, a monument to modern ambition, proof that the impulse to rebuild Babel never truly fades. Spiritually speaking, Saddam's Babylon stands as this kind of vivid parable for our age. A ruler used architecture to chase immortality, just as Nebuchadnezzar did. And Daniel 4 declaring, "It is not the great Babylon which I have built my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty." I think history repeated itself, almost word, for the moral remains unchanged. No matter how many bricks bear a ruler's name, it is God who writes the final inscription. And we saw things didn't work out great for Saddam just a few years later when he was hung by his own people. So the kings did fall there as well. And he met a horrific end. But I thought it was interesting that he was trying to resurrect that. And we saw it with great people in the past, like Alexander, who also too tried to take over that, and also too resulted in his death.
Yeah, man, it seems like Babylon is cursed. They seem to draw these big, larger than life figures, and they all end up dying in strange, rather sudden ways. It's also interesting because Nebuchadnezzar II, the Nebuchadnezzar from the Bible that took the Jews into captivity, he built on top of a lot of archaeologists think that Itamakani is the Tower of Babel, which, again, was unfinished once God confused the languages. But Nebuchadnezzar took the credit for building it. And there, and it's much like Saddam, he put his stamps on the base of this temple as well, which is interesting. And I think there was one brick that suggests that, though he took credit for building the whole thing, one brick they found somewhere suggests that it was built on top of the ancient ruins of the Tower of Babel. So it wasn't 5,000 plus feet tall, but it came out to about 300 feet tall, which back then would be a pretty dang tall building.
Yeah, that's impressive. So we talked a lot about the history. Do we want to get into some of the conspiracies surrounding?
Yes, right, I would love to. Have you ever heard of the Hillary Clinton emails?
I haven't. No, I'd love to hear about it.
So there's this conspiracy theory. And so there was like a WikiLeaks leak of 30,000 Hillary Clinton emails. And one of them suggested that she, again, this could be complete conspiracy. It's hard to find any sort of truth. It was a big conspiracy a couple of years ago, especially when all these emails first came out. But like with anything in the internet, it can get scrubbed. But there was this supposed email about her asking like one of the generals or someone out in the Middle East during this war, asking questions about resurrection chamber of Gilgamesh, which, as you've heard in this episode, we think, or it's deduced, that Gilgamesh and Nimrod are the same person. And it was interesting because the conspiracy was that this email came out and the Iraq war started 3 or 4 months later. So a big claim is we didn't invade Iraq for freedom or for terrorists or for oil. We invaded it for the buried ancient technology in Babylon. So it was an interesting, do I believe it? I don't know. There was a freedom of information requests underneath, the name escapes me. It wasn't underneath Hillary Clinton. It doesn't mean that she didn't tell someone to do it, but it was a request for the schematics or all the information about Gilgamesh's resurrection chamber. And I don't know if you've seen him or not. You can look on TikTok, type it in, and there's these videos that are purported to be somebody recording Gilgamesh laying inside of a tomb, and he looks like he hasn't aged a day. His skin looks funky, probably because it's a mannequin and it is completely fake, but it's still fun to think about. But he's got this big robust beard. He looks like a jacked guy. Apparently he's 8 to 13 feet tall, and apparently he's waiting to be resurrected. That's one of the reasons they claim that we actually went to war. And in fact, there was a U.S. base built on top of some of the ruins of the ancient city of Babylon. I just thought that was a fun one to toss in there and let the audience think and ponder on for a minute. It's fun to think about. How true is it? I don't know. It's interesting. It's thought-provoking. But what do you make of it, man?
Wait, did they say why she was interested in it?
No, they didn't. Of course, like with any conspiracy, people read between the lines and make up their own narratives. But I think if I had to put an angle on it, it was try to find lost ancient technology. And another spin is that some Christian theologians, both mostly fringe, think that Nimrod is actually the Antichrist, just waiting to be brought back at the right time to hit the scene again.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. So I've heard a similar theory about the Iraq War. It's called the Babylonian Stargate and the CERN portal conspiracies. Now, if you ever wandered through late night YouTube or prophecy forums, you've probably seen these stories. They claim that the Iraq War was secretly about recovering ancient interdimensional gateway buried beneath Babylon, or that CERN's large Hadron Collider in Switzerland isn't a particle accelerator at all, but a modern Tower of Babel, reopening doorways humanity was never meant to touch. I think the production value is pretty slick. Swirling graphics, ancient symbols, and dramatic music that make the wildest theories feel most plausible. But I think when you look past the editing, the evidence turns out it's mostly vibes and clear video cuts. But I thought it was interesting to do a call back to our last episode. Some people thought the Babylonian Stargate and the CERN portal were somehow connected. And there is a Fall of the World, End of Times motif sprinkled into the CERN portal as well.
Yeah, I know some conspiracy theories think that the Tower of Babel, what they were actually trying to make was an actual Stargate. And the thought, and I don't know who would think that this would work, but they thought they would build a super high tower, put a Stargate on top, and then transport their armies into heaven to overthrow God. Ridiculous sentiment, ridiculous theory. But some conspiracy theorists think that Nimrod was actually trying to break into heaven and take heaven over, and that the Tower of Babel just wasn't a tower trying to profane God, but a tower to actually invade heaven. I guess if you wanted to dig into that a little more, that has a lot to do with the Nephilim and the fallen angels trying to get back there and using humanity as the kind of catalyst to help build this tower and make false promises about sharing power once they overthrow God.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. I can't imagine the pride you must have to think you can overthrow God, but
yeah, who's literally just flooded the world a couple thousand years before you were like walking it. Another, this isn't conspiracy, this is more from the archaeological or written evidence from the time. One of the reasons, I think it's in the Midrash and I think in some Islamic texts, I could be wrong about its location, but according to them, he did build a Tower of Babel to be floodproof, and he was trying to defy God by saying, I'm going to make a tower so large that if you flood the world again, guess what? You're not going to kill me because I'm going to be on top of it, and whoever I want with me will be on top of it. So I'm going to defy you and say you can't do something that you already did. It was a big like affront to God in his own way. A completely logical conclusion if that's true.
Obviously not a well-read man either, because in the Bible it states, I'll never again destroy the world by water.
Exactly. You missed that. But if you think about it, it's pretty weird that humanity fell back into its old practices so soon after getting off the Ark. It was only, that was the fourth generation after the Ark, and you already have this hubris and this ego, and I think it's in all of us to some extent. We have big egos, our smallest accomplishments we want to make into these big, fantastical things, and man and woman can really think a whole lot about themselves with very little achievements, just because you might look good, or you might be big, you might be strong, or people might like you, or you can push the little guy around.
Yeah, being humble is very hard, and sinning is very easy. And the things we're not supposed to do seem to sometimes come quicker than the things that we are supposed to do, because it's the easy way out, it's the lazy way out, or it's the prideful way out. And we see the fall of mankind come quick. We saw it when Jesus walked the earth, man still fell. They saw the Lord and Savior and they fell. They saw people that actually talked to God. You think they talked to God, they heard from God, they got scriptures down from the mountain. They know he exists, it's clear as day, but yeah, for Moses could return, they're already worshiping a bull. Like, it shows how quickly we fall and how ultimately stupid, even if we think we're wise, we are.
Yeah, one of the other fringe and alternative theories is it roots back to this whole ancient aliens, Anunnaki, extraterrestrial intervention. Some theorists claim the tower was a launch pad, a spaceship, or an energy device built with alien assistance, and God or gods were extraterrestrial who intervened to prevent humanity from accessing advanced tech. So you have that whole ancient alien spin with it. In one variant, aliens are sent by God to scatter people and to confuse languages. Another one kind of ties it to the sons of God from Genesis, quote unquote, as fallen angels or alien hybridizing with humans, with the tower as a gateway for the return. We can be critical of this and probably chop it up pretty quick, but it's interesting and fun to think about, but it seems far-fetched. I'd be more inclined to believe that it was a place to maybe summon a deity, maybe a portal to allow fallen angels to come through. Again, post-flood, four generations after the fact, there has to be pretty concise stories about what happened pre-flood with the giants and the fallen angels. It couldn't have been washed out that fast in four generations, especially with these people living hundreds of years. You could almost reference someone that had gotten off the ark, your grandfather in his case, with being Ham. I would think Ham would still be alive around them. I'm not entirely sure, but at least your father would have these stories, his grandfather Noah or his father Ham. And I just don't know why you want to open that door back up knowing what it did in the first place.
Yeah, he had even had kids that could pass down the stories for greater generations. A lot of the times you mention aliens in that narrative, and a lot of times I think people see stuff that they don't know how to explain, and they attach alien to it. When you look at the Bible, and especially when you look at the higher levels of heaven, they really have some fantastical beings up there. I remember a clock with eyes, and like they talk about all these different types of spirits that worship God, and it's not always in human form. And I wonder if some people throughout the history of time have been visited by different angels that did not take on human form, and the only way they explained it was that it was an alien. It must be from outer space. In reality, it is coming from the heavens, perhaps not outer space, but it is coming from the heavens. So I don't know. You hear that a lot with the Anunnaki. Like the Anunnaki, or I think this story goes that they were like a ancient alien breed, like on some planet X, like way out in outer space. But many people actually connect it to fallen angels. So I always just wonder if there's some confusion there of seeing aliens, it's actually something spiritual, but they don't know how to quantify it.
Technically, fallen angels would be considered aliens, right? They're extraterrestrials. Like, their dominion was not Earth. To fall in line with the thought that aliens and or UFOs, or what we're seeing as a UFO, are not people from other galaxies or in a land far away. I think they're interdimensional beings phasing in and out of our reality. I'm with you there.
I think most people, when they think of aliens, they think of the little green guy, maybe not the green guy, but just like another thing that's like humans. It just happens to be on a different planet. And then they don't want to connect it spiritually. But I do think there is that connective tissue.
Yeah. So to get on to other, like a couple other conspiracies here, another theory is that this structure was a temple to create a unified hive mind, stripping everyone of their individuality and setting up like perfect harmony under Nimrod. So essentially what it's suggesting is that he was creating the tower to essentially control everybody, to do what he wanted to do, to be the leader of this Borg, quote unquote.
Yeah, that's a good one. Have you heard of the Oath of Nimrod connected to Freemasons?
I haven't. I have heard that a lot of Freemasonry uses Nimrod in a lot of their writings, but tell me.
Yeah, so of all those hidden links that really swirl around Nimrod's name, the one tied to Freemasons is among the oldest and I think most persistent. The ideal surfaces in a set of medieval Masonic manuscripts known as the Old Charges, which was guild records copied and recopied from roughly the 14th and 18th centuries. A few of these lists of legendary founders mention Nimrod as a patron of builders or a mighty master of masons. In their original context, these stories were part of the craft's folklore, a way for stonemasons to root their trade in biblical antiquity and really to present their work as divinely honorable. They never claimed that Nimrod created a secret order. He was simply another name in a mythic genealogy of builders stretching from Adam's sons through Noah to Solomon's temple. However, especially those outside the fraternity took the tiny reference and built a myth around it. By the 1700s and the 1800s, anti-Messianic writers began to recast Nimrod not as a craftsman hero, but as the original rebel, a forerunner of the mystery religions of Babylon. And that retelling, the Oath of Nimrod, supposedly bound masons to preserve forbidden knowledge passed down from Babel. 20th century conspiracy books ran even further with the ideal, linking Freemasons, the Illuminati, and global politics into one vast continuity of defiance against God. You know, it's an exciting story, but one I think that is mostly built on the imagination rather than evidence. The surviving manuscripts, archived and analyzed in collections such as the Phoenix Masonry, say nothing about world dominion, only about geometry, wages, and moral duty. But the manuscripts are real, and the grand conspiracy perhaps is not. But it is interesting as we trace back the history that Nimrod's name is in the Freemason culture, and the Freemasons are connected to a lot of stuff. So I don't know if people later twist the tale or it started from there. It's really hard to make those determinations. Perhaps the old charge has something that's secret. Perhaps they have some knowledge that was passed down, and you start to see those things on everything. It's even on our currency.
Yeah, interesting stuff. He seems to be tied up with the occult pretty heavily, and this I wouldn't even categorize as this as a conspiracy, but I guess the last thing I wanted to point out was that the Tower of Babel was a Luciferian symbol for apotheosis. So it represented the serpent's lie in Eden, that humans can become gods, and the tower was commissioned by Nimrod for self-deification, embodying the cult doctrines of ascension without divine aid. I think ultimately that's probably what it was. I think he thought so highly of himself and had so much power and had done, at least in his lifetime, he did stuff that he never saw cities, he never saw empires, and he was post-flood the first one to do that, and it probably got to his head.
There is a lot of fascinating things about this. One of the ones that I thought was pretty interesting was Nimrod and what was called the Two Babylons. It all traces back to the 19th century, this Scottish minister named Alexander Hislop, who published a book in 1853 called The Two Babylons, Papistry and Adultery. His thesis was sensational. He claimed that virtually every pagan religion on earth, from ancient Egypt to classical Rome, descended from a single primeval cult founded by Nimrod and his supposed queen. According to Hislop, this Babylonian mystery of religion survived the flood of time and quietly infiltrated later civilizations, even blending into Christian traditions under new names. It's a powerful story. And if true, I could see why you'd want to confuse some tongues when it came to Babel, because a lot of crazy cults have populated the earth since that time. So I thought that one was interesting. And then the last one I wanted to touch on was the conspiracy that involves the EU Parliament. It's called the Babel Building. I think here's one of the internet's most viral architectural legends. It claims that the European Union Parliament building in France was deliberately designed to mimic Peter Bruegel's and Elder's 16th century painting, the Tower of Babel. And you've probably seen the side-by-side images. Bruegel's spinning, half-finished tower next to the parliament, curved glass and steel exterior. The story usually comes with a sinister twist, screenshots of supposed EU posters that reads, "Many tongues, one voice." For some, it's proof that the modern European project is a consistent revival of the Babel's rebellion. I think it's a gripping narrative, and the visual similarities are real. The Parliament Weiss building does feature an open, unfinished-looking upper ring, a design choice that immediately recalls Bruegel's painting. But I think when you dig into the records and interviews, the resemblance turns out to be more coincidental.
Yeah, man. Interesting episode. There's a lot of information out there. So what's your take on Nimrod and Tower of Babel?
I think the Tower of Babel isn't anti-city, anti-technology, or anti-progress. I think is anti-self-exaltation. The problem wasn't ambition, it was direction. Humanity wanted permanence, not purpose. Identity without obedience. I think Babel reminds us that when we build only to make a name, God resists. When we build to serve, to heal, to bless, God partners. I think every generation has its towers, skyscrapers, networks, economies, algorithms. None of them are inherently evil by nature. All of them carry moral weight. I think the question is timeless. Whose name is on the cornerstone? When our towers serve the common good, when they lift others up rather than ourselves, our buildings become worship. But when our towers exist only to glorify the builder, they crumble into dust, just like the ziggurats on the plains of Shinar. The real message of Babel isn't that God feared our strength, it's that he loved us too much to let our pride destroy us. The confusion was mercy. The scattering was grace. Every tower since then is an invitation. Build boldly, but build humbly. And remember, no matter how high our walls reach, heaven always comes down by invitation, not construction.
Yeah, man. I think Nimrod was a real person. I think lots of cultures talk about him and they just call him by different names. The stories line up. There are some discrepancies, but a lot of the underlying themes are similar. And I think the Tower of Babel was, I don't know, I struggle with that one because I leaned toward a little bit toward the conspiratorial side. I think he was definitely trying to deify himself. I definitely think he was trying to make himself God on earth. And was there some sort of hand behind him pushing him to do this, either aware or unaware? I don't know. That's an interesting one. And I'm going to have more time to think about that before I draw my final conclusion. But either way, I think there's plenty of historical, archaeological, and linguistic evidence to suggest that all of our languages root back to one, and around 4,000 or 5,000 years ago they all scattered almost seemingly instantaneously, and hundreds if not thousands branched out pretty quickly. Interesting story, interesting episode, and lots of interesting research involved in this. But like usual, Jesus loves you, we love you, and I love you, brother.
We love you. Love you, brother. Until next time, we are Zero Signal.
Oh, one more thing. Email us zerosignaltruth@gmail.com and we're out.
We've hit the 0 hour. That's a wrap on this week's transmission. New episodes drop weekly, so stay tuned and don't miss the next signal. Follow, subscribe, and spread the word. You've been listening to Zero Signal. We're out.